We are back. Just wanted to mix it up, you know. Come in the gate hot. Because here's the deal. Today's episode, this week's episode, y'all, put on your seatbelts, put on a helmet, throw a mask on, put on your gloves, get ready, because my guy, Broderick Greer, is up in the podcast house today. It's going to be so, so good. If you are unaware of Broderick Greer, he used to have a large presence on Twitter. He's now primarily on Instagram, but he is an Episcopal priest. He is a thoughtful man who has wonderful, wonderful insight, perspective, wisdom that people have been coming to and seeking after for quite some time now. He is hilarious. He is just an amazing person. I'm excited for you to get to know him a little more, and maybe in some new and unique ways. He's got a wonderful website. He hosts a podcast. He does a lot of different things. Check him out, Broderick Greer online. You will not be disappointed. But we got an episode we need to get to, so let me get you to it. But before we do that, I don't know. I just want to give a shout out to all of you for hanging in there with me and being fans of the podcast, sharing the podcast, liking things on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. It means the world to me. So I just want to say thank you. I like to say that every now and then, is to say thanks for all of the love and support. Keep it going. Also know that I'm coming out with a Patreon page soon. I'm going to start cooking it up. We're in the process right now. So definitely be on the lookout for that. If you haven't already checked out the website, go check out our new website, patrickpodcast.com. The best part about the podcast is that there's a section called Patrick's Picks, and it has some of my favorite books, restaurants, music, etc. So definitely go and check that out. Okay, Ben, what's up?
Not much. I was just checking out the website here. I love it. I love it.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. I love how bold the homepage is. It's just, it's bam, Patrick.
It's my face right there. That's a Bonnaroo pick.
Yeah.
And Bonnaroo happened in June usually, and we missed
that
it.
That bandana. Patrick, I had a Corona scare.
Oh no.
Yeah, it was quite the ordeal. Came down with a fever. Woke up early in the morning and had a fever. Got kind of nervous about it. I don't get fever very often.
Right.
My body temperature is usually low, and I just noticed, like, as soon as I woke up, I was like, I have a fever. Took my temperature, it did. Immediately, as soon as it opened up, went to a walk-in clinic and talked to them, told them that I'd been to the protest, so, you know, I'd been exposed to several people.
Wow.
And got my test back within actually like 10 hours, which is kind of insane.
Whoa. That is insane.
Especially, I feel really blessed about it. I don't really know why. I feel guilty about it. I don't know why. I've heard people waiting for 6 days to get their results back, and even more. But within like 10 hours, I got my test back, and it was negative, which was great. But just going through that experience itself, having to warn my roommates not to come into my room.
Is that the test they put up your nose? Did you do that one?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like, I heard it like touches your brain.
Through your nose.
Ah!
Yeah.
No!
But, yeah, just wanted to remind everybody that the virus is still out there. It's still real. I don't have it, which is amazing, and I'm so thankful for, but it's still out there, and it's very real, and I know that recently, like, experts have been trying to warn that the second wave is going to be worse if we're not careful, and so just... I just wanted to encourage everybody to keep doing a good job.
Yeah.
you know, isolating as much as you can. I know that we do have to return to some sort of life, and right. you have to work and do all that and be with your friends in some sort of way. But, you know, if you have the option of still being able to do takeout yeah. versus staying in a restaurant, you know, just do that instead and still yeah. be smart and hopefully the second wave won't be as bad as the first one.
Yeah. And here's the deal, people. Wearing a mask, what a low bar. What a low bar of what you can do to be a good neighbor in your city. Like, wearing a mask is not that bad. You'll be okay. Put a mask on and, you know, just take, yeah, like you said, social distance. Don't put yourself, there are tons of photos that we keep seeing online of, like, bars and downtown restaurants in different cities just packed to the brim. Folks, no, this ain't the time. This is not the time. So, yeah, I agree with you. The virus is still real. Take care of yourselves, okay? Wash your hands. Wash your face. Wear a mask. Washing your face was a new thing for me. I just want you to wash your face. All right. Enjoy the show. We'll see you next time. Peace. All right, everybody. Welcome back to the show. So excited to have you back on the podcast with me. And today, folks, we have a special guest. Like all of my guests are special, but I'm excited for today. We've got Broderick Greer up in the podcast house. How's it going?
I'm well. Thank you so much for having me.
It's good. So I'm so excited about what all we're going to talk about. And for those of you who are tuning in, we will likely cover just about everything that you think you would like for us to cover in this conversation, perhaps. And if we don't, then we don't, and you'll be fine. You'll be okay. Be strong. But yes, so it's so interesting because I think there are many folk who know of you or know you because of Twitter or Instagram now, or even the work that you've done in the world of podcasting yourself. And so there's a lot of folks that have contact with you, but you are currently living in Denver, correct?
I am.
And tell us about your current gig.
Yes. So my current gig, or job.
Yeah.
is I'm salaried. So
yeah, you're salaried. Yeah.
I work at St. John's Cathedral, which is an Episcopal church in Capitol Hill here in Denver. And there, if it were a Baptist church, I would be called the worship pastor. So I am, yes. I work very closely with our worship staff, which there are three of us who are full time, and then all of our lay volunteers. And then also I work very close with our director of music and his staff on planning worship and executing worship. The good kind of execution.
Yeah, that's right.
And I also coordinate our young adult ministry. So if I were at a mega church, I'd be called the young adult pastor. And that's so much fun. And with that, we do a monthly podcast called Mile High Theology, where we explore the big questions of meaning, justice, and belonging. And that is just so much fun. And then, you know, in addition to that, there are only three clergy. So I'm, you know, really a part of, strategy and, helping my boss with whatever he needs and working with my other colleague, we're a staff of 14, so it's not huge. Right, we're pretty lean. We like to say we're lean and nice instead of lean and
lean and mean. That's right. That's right.
But it's a joy. I've been at St. John's for almost 3 years.
Wow. And 3 years.
Yeah, it's amazing. I was in Memphis for 2 years before.
Yeah, that's right.
And loved it. But, you know, Denver has been a great fit. And, you know, our liturgies at St. John's are compelling and beautiful. And it's just fun work.
Now, even in the Episcopal tribe, there's some movement that happens with, like, clergy and people who are kind of on the staff, correct?
Isn't yes.
There? So, mm-hmm. So you've been there for 3 years. Do you kind of have a sense that, like, I'm going to be grounded here for, and not like in a bad way, but grounded in a good kind of way here for a while? Or do you, or is it like, I don't know the full process, but is it like a possibility that there's another move coming?
Well, unlike United Methodists or Catholics, we are not, moved places.
Okay. So that's what I was, okay.
We elect to go places.
There we go.
And it's a mutual discernment. So as St. Paul says in the letter to the Philippians, it is my sincere hope and expectation in Christ that I will remain here for a long time.
Yes. Very good. Very good. Now, that begs a bigger question for me, which is, was this always the dream to be this worship young adult? I mean, obviously, you probably didn't dream of being a podcaster as a 16-year-old, but was ministry and work in this kind of way, music, was that something that you as a 16-year-old like dreamed about, or was there other ideas that you had in mind?
Yes, my grandmother was a minister of music in her church, in the church that I was baptized in. I grew up in an Afro-Baptist church in Texas, and there's a rich history of kind of Afro-Baptists in Central and East and North Texas. And I was fifth generation Afro-Baptist, and my parents were still in that tradition. And so, you know, there are certain things about that I can't shake.
Yeah,
it just stays in my bones. And then I did a tour in Churches of Christ as a teenager.
It really is a tour sometimes.
Yeah, it was for me. You know, I've been, what's crazy to think about, and my mind works this way, I've been in the Episcopal Church longer than I was Church of Christ, which is unbelievable.
Wow.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. But it was a rich experience in many ways. And I went to a Church of Christ college in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And it was really in the Church of Christ at age 16 that I began preaching and sort of imagining what life might look like as a minister. Did not think that would end up with me becoming an Episcopal priest.
Right, yeah.
I couldn't even pronounce Episcopal, let alone explain what it was. But through a series of events, it is where I landed, and it really does feel like home, and it is home.
Right.
So, yes and no to that question.
Sure.
I definitely could have. I know when I was in college, I definitely wanted to be a worship minister.
Oh, like, yeah.
That was my dream.
Was to be a worship minister, yeah.
Yeah, and I've always been interested in liturgy, even as a Baptist. Because I always tell people, you know, people like to think that only Episcopalians and Methodists and Catholics and Presbyterians and, well, some Presbyterians and Orthodox Christians have liturgy.
Right.
And that's not true.
That's not true.
All churches have liturgy, whether it's written down or not.
Absolutely.
It's been fun. It's something I never could have imagined and yet imagined my whole life.
Right. Now, so I guess just to stay here for just maybe a little bit longer, which is, do you pinpoint a moment of like, okay, I'm going to go down this road to become an Episcopal priest? Like, this is it. Like, It was there a, as they like to say, a crossroad moment for you where you're like, okay, like this is the new direction? Because you know, in some ways you had the freedom to kind of choose a variety of paths and still kind of be connected to worship and ministry in that particular way. But what was there a moment where you're like, okay, this is, from at least what I know, this is the next right best step?
That's a good question. I don't think there was a moment. I remember, I remember being in college and I started attending an Episcopal church in college, and they had, you know, just the smartest, most kind of artful priest one could ask for. And, you know, we struck up a friendship and he would say, Broderick, you're an Episcopalian and you don't know it. Like he said that all the time. And, you know, looking back, it's like, oh, actually, that's so true. Like, why did I, as a kid, like as this Black Baptist kid in Texas, have like this Life magazine about John Paul II? You know, like, why was I so drawn to vestments and, you know, kind of higher church expressions of music and things like that? Like, I mean, we were kind of dancing, clapping Baptists. Like, what on earth was the draw? And yet it was there from an early age. And I remember sitting on a worship committee at a Church of Christ in college, and I was kind of still, I was definitely still Church of Christ, but I was flirting with the Episcopal Church and would go to church there.
As most Church of Christ people do.
Well, yeah, there's definitely a pipeline, and I'm not a proselytizer, but there's definitely a pipeline. And I was sitting, I was in this committee, and I just made some suggestions that I, you know, just things that I thought were kind of obvious. And after the committee was over, no one at the church knew I had also been attending the Episcopal Church.
Right.
And this woman came up to me, I'll never forget it, and she said, Broderick, you sound like an Episcopalian.
You're like, oh, shoot.
Yeah, she was serious. I mean, she wasn't being critical.
Right,
she
no, was not. Yeah.
I mean, it was just an observation.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my goodness, maybe
this is
I am. And I'm one of those people that's not, I have to be told things like 3 or 4 times before I get it. So I would have been perfect as like a disciple of Jesus, like 10 times.
Right.
And so it was like sort of in that moment, and it was a series of things, but really I was like, oh yeah, maybe.
Yeah,
I need to just stop fighting it,
right,
and just give in.
Sometimes I'm the kind of person that like every door needs to be closed and locked and stuff in front of it. And then I'm like, are you sure I can't go through this other door though? And it's like, no, you can't. No, there's no way. And it's like, okay, I guess I'll go through the one that you've been leaving open the whole time.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. So, okay, you grew up in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, there is the word out there is that, like, you know, Black folks who are from Texas are just they just kind of have a different flavor to them, a different way of being and operating.
I didn't know this.
Yes. I mean, you know, you've got, you know, there are some of the biggest musicians right now, the living are from, you know, from Houston area. And it's like, there's just a way
Beyonce
and our the one that has the real big song now, oh my goodness, people will be so mad at me for not remembering her name. Oh, the ratchet.
Is it Megan Thee Stallion?
Yeah, Megan Thee Stallion. Thank you.
Oh, I didn't know she's a Texan.
Yeah, I think she's a Texan. That's
right. Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, once you know it, you're like, yeah, that makes sense. And that's what I mean.
Well, Black people in Texas ride horses.
Yeah, you so know, that's like, what that's I'm saying, thing. Right?
Yeah, it's very
so strange. It's just fun. You know, it's a different than, like, I was born in Birmingham, Alabama, family from Selma, Alabama. So, like, there's just a certain, and it's just, there's very much similarities, but there's very different kind of way of being brought up into the world. So I'm curious, like, what, I'm still looking for more understanding and language around, like, being Black and being raised in hot Texas. It's hot.
Yeah, it is very hot, which is why I live in Colorado now.
That's right.
It's like 10% humidity here, which is like one day in January in Texas.
Right.
For my own family, I'm sixth generation Texan, depending how you read it. And our family got there, as far as we know, on my mom's side. I mean, on my mom's dad's side. So my mom's patrilineal side in 1852.
Wow.
And from Georgia, they were enslaved and they were brought there by a white family. And subsequently, the second generation of the black family and the white family had children, which created the third generation, which is this whole, I mean, it's literally in a book.
Wow.
Right there on my coffee table. And so our family has deep, deep roots in rural East Texas, which is wooded and very culturally Southern. Accents, food, everything. It is Southern culture.
Wow.
And then when in the 1950s, my grandmother, or 1940s, my grandmother and her siblings, their parents, both of their parents died within 6 months of each other in 1947. And they moved, the kids moved either to Fort Worth mm-hmm. or to San Diego, California, which is very common because it was also at the end of the Great Migration.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of black people from Texas settled in San Diego and LA.
That's okay.
So a lot of our family lives in LA as okay. well. And so, but we were the part that stayed. And I've been reading this wonderful book called The Old Ship of Zion, and it's all about Afro-Baptist ritual. It's so, I have weird interests. But it's all about
that's amazing,
Afro-Baptist though. Ritual and in specifically Central Texas. So the area around Austin. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in North Central Texas, but my family is from East Texas. So all of these regions have very distinct regional identities.
Which some people don't recognize that like Texas is not just Texas. Like there's definitely kind of there's vibes and
yeah.
and very, you know, there's very distinct, you know, kind of ways of being in Texas.
Yeah, it's like five different states.
Right.
And what I realized, even though I grew up in an urban setting on the east side of Fort Worth, mm-hmm. went to integrated schools, all this stuff, my church that I grew up in, we, quote, fellowshipped, end quote, with churches not only in Fort Worth, but a lot of rural Central Texas churches.
Interesting. Yeah.
And so our grammar of faith very much reflected that. Our, you know, in this book, he talks about kind of the two frames of Afro-Baptist liturgy in Texas. And the first frame opens with what's called devotion. And devotion is usually all a cappella. And mm-hmm. it's European American hymns that have been completely changed into an African style. And they have no meter.
Right.
They are very much a snapshot into like 150 years ago. It sounds the way a church like that would have sounded 150 years ago. And then once you're done with that part of the service, you jump into the more ecstatic, inspirited, celebratory music that's more contemporary. And the preaching is in our vernacular, but that old music from the first frame
right.
is not in our vernacular. So long story short, I had this very rich upbringing where I was around all of these old black people who, including my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, who knew people who were enslaved.
Wow.
you know, and use these phrases in church. You know, like my grandmother in church, she would always, even though she was the minister of music, so because she was the minister of music, we didn't get to sit with her very much because she was always up at the piano.
Right.
But every once in a while, she would be able to come and sit with us in the congregation, maybe like during the sermon. Or when I was a kid, I would go up and sit with her kind of in that pit where the piano was. And she would almost go into this trance-like thing where she would close her eyes and she would say, "Thank you, Master."
Wow.
Which when you look at that on the surface, it's like, oh, that, you know, that's like some repression. That's right. Some, you know, white supremacist stuff going on, you know, for someone born in 1931 to still be using language like that.
Right.
But I think another reading of that is that my grandmother and so many Black people of her age and era, God was the only master they knew.
Mm.
And it was a vernacular way of saying that God is in some way the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, and that white supremacy has no place
right.
in her imagination, in her prayer life, in her life at all. It really is. God was her all in all and superseded kind of the forces of white supremacy in her life. And what a gift to be brought up that way.
Right.
With such beauty and such grace and such poetry, the poetry of how those people prayed growing up. I mean, it's you know, thanking God for the multiplication of your limbs,
right?
And that your sleeping bed was not your cooling board. I mean, just all of these beautiful phrases that come straight out of enslavement,
right?
So I really feel like I was granted a gift of being. Knowing that final generation that knew enslaved people.
Yeah. Yeah.
What a gift.
That is for sure a gift. I mean, the lessons that are learned from that. Because there are so many now there's so many Black people who don't have memories or that kind of connection.
Yeah.
For a variety of reasons.
Yes.
You know? And so what's so beautiful about what you've just done for everyone listening is like, and what you get to be to those who are really good friends to you, it's like you get to pass those stories down, which is so important to do, so that we don't forget like this history and this heritage and all of this that is wrapped up in that. And so I'm interested in another kind of like angle with this, which is you've now kind of existed in very diverse, like church worship, you know, worlds. You've been in so many different spaces. You know, sometimes it's like it's all Black. Sometimes it's, you know, many kind of culturals and cultures and ethnicities. Sometimes you're the only Black person in the room. You know, I've been in a lot of ways. And yeah, and then of course, like there's just the different kind of denominational, you know, kind of like journey you've gone on. And so I'm interested in this because this is something that I will occasionally get asked, and I'm always trying to think about like why that may be the case. And so when I meet someone who has had a somewhat similar journey, I'm always interested in their take on it, which is typically, and this is not always, this is not an all call. This is just a generally speaking, mm-hmm. predominantly Black churches are pretty the tagline is pretty progressive socially and very conservative theologically.
Interesting.
And so like there's this like definitely this like openness and progression in socially speaking, right? But then when it comes to theological, some of the like what are we saying when we read the Bible and how we're working, making sense of that, tends to be, to use that kind of tired word, conservative, right? I mean, we can spend all day talking about, well, that, what does that actually mean? And, you know, and this, that, and the other, but like, that's kind of been, and so people are like, why, like, do you know why that may be? And I'm like, that's an interesting question. Cause when I step back, I'm like, yeah, I mean, I think about some of the people that I've grown up with, I'm like, yeah, they're, when it comes to like thinking about the Bible and spirituality and faith, they are very traditional conservative, but then other things wide open, ready to roll it up and let loose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think one of the most helpful things I've ever heard someone say is that white people came to Jesus through the Bible. Mm. And black people came to the Bible through Jesus. So there was a, you know, black people before enslaved black people were even Christian in this country, they had the story of Brother Rabbit.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of similarities between Brother Rabbit and Jesus and trickery and the resurrection. And the, you know, I always heard growing up, the resurrection was always framed as a joke on Satan, that it was a, what is that called? It's like a, I'm sorry.
No, it's, no, it's fine.
It's the, a practical joke.
Yeah, like a pat. Yes, yes.
And that's how preachers would end their sermons. And so there is a playfulness about metaphor and story and at least an imagination. You know, some preachers would say, if they're preaching, they would say, you know, now think about this with your sanctified imagination. And sanctified imagination is a very specific term that says, suspend your logic for a moment.
Right.
And they would, you know, say things like, and Dr. Will Gaffney, she talks about this in her book, Womanist Midrash. She'd be like, you know, Joseph was so rich that he had, 24-inch rims on his chariot.
Right, right.
And we know that Joseph didn't have rims on his you know, but like that was a part of the sanctified imagination. So even though black churches can be literalists about scripture, there is still a playfulness there.
Right.
And a relaxed place with it, because at the end of the day, and I know they wouldn't necessarily say this, but I think in practice, at the end of the day, for most black Christians I know, I think there are few exceptions, and they tend to be ones who are very adjacent to white evangelicals. But for black Christians who are self-referential to just other black people, Jesus is more important than the Bible.
Yep, that's right.
And that is a gift, because that's how the church has generally been.
Right.
You know, the church didn't have the Bible as we know it today until the fourth, fifth century. So it was the stories about Jesus that then led to the Bible being formed. Jesus predates the Bible. And I think that there's something to be said about that.
Right.
And I think that that kind of shoots at the heart of the tension that you're speaking of.
Hmm. That's good. I like that. I think that's right. I think that's right. Okay. So I as we move on a little bit here, I'm curious, as it's kind of changing gears a little bit, but you know, you have hosted many podcast episodes and in-person gatherings where you're the moderator and you're kind of pulling out things out of these guests that you have, right?
Yes.
So I'm always wanting to hear other people's like process and how they go about doing that work. Because I mean, you know, there is an art to the conversation. There's an art to doing any kind of conversation, generally speaking, but especially in large gatherings and digitally on podcasts and other platforms. And I'm curious, like, for you, what have you been learning or you've learned over the years as you've gotten into this work of hosting conversations, having podcasts, you know, episodes and conversations? What have you learned about people and just the process in general?
I like to spend as much time with the person before the interview as I do during the interview, if not more before, because I go into that initial conversation very open-minded. Mm-hmm. You know, I definitely have what I want to talk to them about and usually have a script, a sample to give them. But I really like, you know, just sort of teasing out what makes them excited and feel alive. Because that's the only thing that's going to keep people coming back to our podcast.
Absolutely.
Is if they are excited about what they're discussing. And so sometimes I'll have to scrap my initial questions because I'll notice that they are really lighting up about this. And so we're like, okay, this is what we're going to go with, not what we had planned on going with. And that's fun, is using that initial conversation before the interview to build rapport, especially if I don't know them, and just be comfortable in one another's presence before, before the actual live interview.
Yeah. And I mean, and I think that's something that I can teach someone, you know, a lot of things, but sometimes like building good rapport with people is just something that you learn over time or you don't. And some people are really great at it and some people struggle with it. And I think that you're right. It's like this, how comfortable can I become with this guest and how quickly can we get there? Because, you know, we've all listened to conversations where it feels like this person's asking a question, they're answering the question. And now it feels cluggy and chunky. I don't know if chunky is the word I want it, but you know, it feels a little bit, you know, not natural versus when it's like, oh, those people, they must really know each other well. Cause it seems so at ease. Like that person's at ease. They're at ease. It's very interesting. Yeah.
But I'm also sort of a, you know, I like to drive conversation. I'm much more comfortable, you know, interviewing than being interviewed. And a friend of mine who's been to a couple of the podcast episodes, he says, Broderick, when you are ready to change the subject, you say, "That's amazing." And then you literally, the next breath,
time to the next time.
It's another subject. I'm like, wow.
Yeah. And you go back and listen, you're like, oh no. No, you should have said, "That's amazing." And
it just changed. Amazing. So I have some tics, apparently, which is really funny as a host to like, oh, because I've been doing this now for 5 years.
Right.
And it's, yeah, it's fun. It's actually one of the funnest things that I get to do in my job.
Oh, absolutely. I've enjoyed it and you're great at it. And it's just fun to watch other people do the thing that you also love. So it's I always love listening to a podcast or of someone else. And it's like, how do you get, okay, let's see how you get them to say the things that you want them to say. Like, let's see where you take this thing. It's just fun.
My favorite host tick right now is Michael Barbaro from the New York Times, The Daily podcast.
Oh, yeah, I hear it.
And he always says, here's what you need to know today. And he says it like that every time. And it's so funny and weird. And they even did a segment one time about that. And like they've tried to coach him to like not say it that way, but like. Now it's become sort of ubiquitous with the show that he says that. Like, it's so weird and funny.
That's great. That's great. Now, speaking of like presence with podcasts and even with podcasting and with these things you host, there's a way about marketing and letting people know about it. Now, as we were saying at the top, a lot of people knew you or know you from your heyday in the Twitter world.
Mm-hmm. In the Twitter sphere.
In the Twitter sphere. Now, so yes. What I guess if you and you know, we have to get into like the details of all of that, but I mean, I'm curious, as you have now stepped away from Twitter for, you know, quite some time now, what's kind of your, as you look at it, as you stand away from it now and you look at, and you're kind of seeing Twitter as it is, mm-hmm. you know, what's your, I guess your hot take, your take on Twitter and even the way that we, and as we kind of move into some of the stuff we're going to talk about, even social media in general, because it is, we are slowly like, because even now there's a space like Instagram that for a long period of time was pretty like void of the social justice kind of content. And now it's like full on, like it's as in it as Twitter has been in it for, you know, quite some time.
Yeah. I would say that for me, I've now accepted that I'm like 19 hours behind the news at all times. That was the best part of Twitter, was like getting things sometimes even before they broke.
Oh yeah.
That was awesome. And I would get frustrated with friends who'd send me articles and I'm like, I saw that 2 days ago. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, what are you doing?
And now I'm that friend. And I'll send people, be like, oh, this is so interesting. And they're like, yeah, we saw that last Thursday. You know, it's Tuesday now. So that's been humbling to now have the shoe on that other foot. So that's what I miss most. I don't miss arguing with people I don't know.
Wow.
That I've never met.
Yeah.
Because I did that a lot. And that's nice. It's nice to not argue with people I don't know.
Yeah.
Someone tried it on Instagram a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I had to like kind of wipe off the dust from my block button. I hadn't used it in a while because I used to block people all the time on Twitter.
This old button. Let's see.
Exactly.
How this
let's
works.
See what this can do on Instagram. So that was nice to exercise that. But you know, I think but nothing really compares to kind of the instant news.
Oh yeah,
that you get on Twitter. It's unparalleled. I would say no other platform can perfect that, but no other platform is interested in doing it because all the other platforms are driven by algorithms. And the closer Twitter began inching toward being algorithm based
right.
instead of being in real time, the less interest I had in it.
Yeah.
And then I had seen so many cycles of dialogue that begin with like shock and anger and, you know, apathy and whatever.
Right.
That it was like, I just already know how this is going to end every time.
Yep.
And it's like when something becomes that predictable, is it really, you know, is it really worth my time?
Is it worth it? Yeah.
And yeah, so I feel good about it. I've been away for like 11 months. I sound like an addict. Exactly.
I miss it. But I don't.
I do. And I don't. You know, I sometimes didn't like the person that I felt myself becoming.
Mm-hmm.
Very skeptical of people. Very quick to be in conflict. And you know, I think I never adjusted to you know, I was on Twitter a long time before I actually had a pretty public platform. So I still, at the end, was tweeting as if I was tweeting to 50 of my closest friends, which is what I did for like the first 5 years. I was basically on Twitter for 10 years. And the first 5 years was that way. And I never got out of that mindset, even at the end.
Yeah.
And so I never had a strategy. I never monetized it. I never, you know, I never was like savvy with it.
And I'm always impressed on people who are that savvy.
Yes.
And like, I'm just like, because I think about it and then I'm like, oh, that sounds so exhausting.
Yeah.
To like, and it's like, I would just rather, like you said, tweet as if I'm tweeting to 50 of my closest friends.
Yeah.
And, oh, that's cool that all of these folks are retweeting or liking it or whatever. But man, I just, yeah, I don't want a team of people that helps me craft the perfect tweet, you know?
Oh my goodness.
Which, you know, some people do. And, you know, I guess.
And I get it. I mean, if I had, I would love to have a staff that did all that. And if I had it and could afford it, I would have it. But I don't.
I don't. It's just me. Yeah. And so I guess that's so interesting. And part of me is I'm always curious about when big moments like this. So now we have all of these deaths, murders of black bodies yet again. And not to say that it hasn't still been happening, because a lot of us were out on these streets, what, 4 years ago? Doing the same thing. And even before then, you know, there was things happening, and I guess what, you know, what has been reminded of us too, is that even with Black Lives Matter, the movement was started under Obama. So it wasn't even that, like, we did it. Put a black man in as president. Everything's good. It's like, no, we still, like, this movement was birthed even in the midst of, like, us as a nation doing a thing, I guess, right? And so I'm curious now, for someone who is, you know, and you said it, you know, so beautifully there, of this cycle that happens. So, okay, we're still kind of in the splash zone of, like, people reposting and retweeting and going to the things, but, like, is this sustainable? Are we going to, you know, is September going to roll around and I'm still seeing people fighting the fight, you know, trying to stick it to the man? Are we going to, is this going to last us to November, which November is coming, right?
It is.
So what's your, as you've been kind of absorbing it and taking it in, what's your take on that?
You know, I think that moments and movements are so important when understood as being in an interplay with one another. Trayvon Martin's murder is what led to one of the three women who founded Black Lives Matter actually writing a Facebook post in which she said, "Our lives matter." And then one of the other of the three then posted and said, "Black Lives Matter."
Right.
And that was 7 years ago, I think in July. And that was a moment that became a movement. And I think that as long as we understand them together, you know, that with all of these social movements that enact sweeping social change and rightful social change, there are usually either a catalyst moment or a series of moments that really fuel the movement.
Right.
And, you know, for some, it was Oscar Grant. Mm-hmm. I believe that was in 2009. For others, it was Trayvon Martin. For others, it was Michael Brown, Sandra Bland, Eric Garner, Breonna Taylor in March of this year, the numerous trans women of color who have been killed, either in intimate partner violence or by police violence. Right. I went to high school with a trans woman who was killed in October of 2018 in our hometown. So it is, people enter these movements usually because of specific moments.
Right.
And sustainability always has to be the big question.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You know, what can I do over a long period of time to contribute to the liberation of Black people? Yes, there are very specific things one can do, you know, right now.
Right.
And what can be done over a lifetime? You know, and just in the 2 weeks, I mean, this is being recorded on June 8th.
Right.
In just 2 weeks, you know, the Minneapolis City Council has committed to disbanding the Minneapolis Police Department. Numerous cities are looking at different levels of defunding their law enforcement agencies. Numerous colleges and other institutions are ending their relationships with police departments all over the country. I mean, this is in 2 weeks.
Right.
This is a movement. Yeah.
Right. Which makes it feel different, right? It makes it feel like, okay, this is Minneapolis. This is different. And which to even that, to that point, what was so interesting as I started to really think about and process, you know, what happened in Minneapolis, I said, okay, wait a minute. Minnesota has the reputation for being called Minnesota Nice, right? On top of that, this is in the mid, it's a Midwest, technically, I think, and still in the Midwestern state.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
Which is like, so you're supposed to be the nicest of the Midwestern states. And in Minneapolis, it's supposed to be this beacon of like liberal, progressive, like it's supposed to be all of this. Yet, here we are.
Yeah, someone has called Minnesota Mississippi with snow. Which.
Oh, that's good. That's your new name, Minnesota.
You know, and they had just had, you know, a police officer kill Jamar Clark in Minneapolis not long before. And I think that's the fascinating part, too, is, you know, at the end of last year, a Tatiana Jefferson was killed in my hometown of Fort Worth, Texas, by police at like 2 o'clock in the morning in her own home. And even though I think a lot of people who are new to all of Lloyd's death sparked this, you know, which is a that's fine to think. But when you kind of hone in and get on the ground level of these activists in these various cities, they begin with George Floyd, and then they're like, and then this person who was killed by police in our town 2 months ago, and this person who was killed 5 years ago. Right. You know, it. Minneapolis is just a stand-in for every other police department in this country.
Right.
It's not a matter of, you know, a few bad apples. The whole tree is poisoned.
Right.
Law enforcement in this country finds its genesis in the slave patrols of the 19th century. It is endemic to police departments across this country that they be anti-Black. Mm. You know, we had a presidential candidate running, Mike Bloomberg, who instituted the stop and frisk.
That's right.
policy in New York City within the last 20 years. So these, and there are a group of black and brown police officers preparing to sue the new NYPD right now for orders they were given by their superiors this year and last to crack down on black and brown people who weren't paying their fare for the subway system.
Wow.
And they were specifically told, don't go after white and Asian people who don't pay their fare. Just go after the black and brown people. So this is endemic.
Right.
So white supremacy is endemic to this country. And many people are realizing this during a pandemic.
Right.
And it's really unbelievable that we have borne witness to all of this for 401 years. And there are people who are saying, oh my goodness, I had no idea. And it's like, no, you did. And you're not going to lie to me. You need to own up to the fact that you did know this was going on. And it is a lot. And I understand you didn't want to acknowledge it, but don't make me seem stupid.
Right. Like, yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. Oh man. It is so fascinating to watch certain people wake up to something that they should have been awake to for a long time.
Yeah.
It's just a really interesting space to be in. It's like, how did you not know? How
exactly.
did you not know? Huh.
It's okay to have those sort of revelatory moments. That's a part of being human.
Yeah.
But to focus so much on, the schools didn't teach me this or da da da. It's like my parents knew that schools weren't going to teach us a lot of things. And so they took it into their own hands to do that.
Right.
To educate us. There's a lot of stuff school didn't teach me about the state of Massachusetts. And yet as a kid, I was obsessed with Massachusetts and read every book I could about Massachusetts. Like there has to be like the things we're interested in, we're going to learn about, we're going to seek out, we're going right. to go after. So, you know, people can blame and blame and blame, but I mean, and these tend to be the people who are the children, at least of people who vote Republican and really are, concerned with personal responsibility. And it's like, you need to take personal responsibility for how much you claim to not know
right.
about a whole segment of our society.
Well, it's like, how many more times do you need to read Lord of the Rings?
Like, exactly.
How many more times you've read it? You've
yeah.
read it. Guess what? There are a lot of books out there about a lot of things that are happening that are real, that are here right
yeah.
now that you don't know. Because, you know, and that's what I was telling a room full of, or Zoom, I guess, room full of people. It's like, we're all believers of higher education.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
you know how to find what you're looking for. You know how to do research. So go mm-hmm. do it. Like, don't put it on to other people to do your work. You know,
yes.
you know what you need to do and you know where to go. It's there. You just have to actually open up your computer. You have Google.
Exactly. And I think, you know, that was one of the things I was not prepared for on Twitter was, you know, in that process of about 5 to 6 years ago of gaining more of a platform, I wasn't prepared for the number of people who would reach out and expect some form of teaching or tutoring about
oh,
white
yeah.
supremacy. And I would think, I didn't sign up for this. And then, and sometimes I would even say that to them and they're like, but you talk about race, you talk about all this. And I'm like, yeah, on my terms. Like, I'm not, this is not what I signed up to do, is to do this kind of one-on-one education. And that's when I became very fond of, you know, telling people, you can Google this. Like, yeah. It's within reach. And there are lots of anti-racist white people who have done that work and are doing it. They're in the process of doing it.
Yeah.
And so it's so important for white people to teach other white people, because we know how segregated the society is.
Right.
And we know that most white people have no substantive friendships with people who are not white. And so we just don't come in contact with them. It's just not a thing that happens for the most part. And so it literally has to be white people who teach other white people, because white people for the most part are only around other white people.
Yeah.
And then, you know, some of it's the interpersonal, but a lot of it is policy.
Oh yeah.
What? It really is. You know, like, people did not start wearing seatbelts until there were policies and regulations around it.
Right.
And you don't, this country legislated and ruled white supremacy into existence.
It's true.
And so it must rule and legislate white supremacy out of existence.
Yeah. And I mean, and there's the thing too, what I'm finding even more interesting is when I see folks, because here's what we know too, because this is true in every kind of part of life, you can find what you're looking for, right?
Yes.
So to this point, and what we're experiencing right now is when I see, you know, some white people posting and reposting from black bodies who are reinforcing that, well, this is all made up and this is all ridiculous. And there's, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, goodness.
And now, you know, I don't want to give these certain folks, like, even, I don't even want to say their names on yeah. my show, because I don't even want to give them the free advertising of, like,
yeah.
saying their name. But there are black and brown people who are on the opposite side of this thing. And now those folks who don't want to do any growth or don't want to believe any of this can say, well, see, look at this yeah. black person. They say this. What wow. do you think about that?
That's so convoluted. And it's sad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sad for those black people who are doing that, you know, basically being a modern day minstrel show. And it's sad for the white people who really need to reinforce their biases. Sad.
Yeah. And so, and part of it is just like, okay, you are showing your hand, and I don't think you meant to show your hand like that. But yeah. you just showed your hand, which for a lot of black folks who say, I would rather see the cards you're holding than for you to never show me the cards you're holding
yeah.
and to just pretend. So, Whew. So I guess, what has it been like in Denver for you? Like, what's that? I mean, I've seen some of the news reports about Denver, but what has it actually been like for you to experience Denver, and even for you in the local church context? Like, how's this, which I'm sure, you know, based upon what I know of you and your work and even the church that you're a part of, it feels like this has been the continuous work that you've been doing. So you're not new to this work of justice and fighting, you know, to end injustices. But what has it been like in somewhere like Denver, which again is known as like a pretty progressive city, but I know that like every city has its issues.
Yeah. Our Bishop of Colorado joined up with the Lutheran bishop and the Methodist bishop and led a march and a prayer vigil last week from St. John's, where I work, to the state capitol, and then over to a police precinct. And actually, that's one of our bishop's priorities. Mm-hmm. She calls them ministry contexts, and racial justice is one of them. And suicide is one, and LGBTQ inclusion in the church is one. And I did not attend, but I did watch it by live stream, you know, just because of some concerns about COVID and things like this. But it was very powerful to see, you know, faith with works, basically.
Yeah.
You know, as St. James talks about. And that's important. It's important that people's convictions take them to the place where they're needed most. Mm-hmm. And that Episcopalians and Lutherans and Methodists, who are very different from one another, can have common ground about a just future for Black people.
Yeah.
But, you know, our mayor enforced a curfew, even though there were, you know, there was really, if there was looting, there was very little in Denver.
Right.
And that was disappointing because, as in many other cities, the curfew was really used as a cover for increased aggression by police.
Right.
You know, someone said, oh, it's amazing that there was so much police brutality at protests about police brutality. the police were just reinforcing what everyone thinks about them. So that was important, and to see our mayor do that, because it was so disappointing.
Right.
And he was just following kind of the orders of law enforcement and the lead of many other mayors across the country.
Right.
It was, you know, an outsized, aggressive reaction that just was unnecessary. You know, Denver is a very white city. Oh, Colorado is a very white state. And we have had major issues with gentrification in Denver in particular over the last 10 years, particularly in our Five Points neighborhood, which is historically Black. And developers and gentrifiers have gone so far as to rename parts of Five Points.
Really?
For development and economic purposes. Yeah, it's really sad. And our mayor has been very pro-developer. But that's the case, you know, in Nashville. That's
the case. Absolutely.
In Seattle, that's the case in a lot of these cities that I wish that liberals would just say, these are havens for white liberals. That's what that means. Mm-hmm. And white liberals of a certain class.
Yeah, but it's temporary, right? Because I'm wanting to be in this area, and then when I have kids, then I'm going to move out, and I'm going to go back to the suburbs to raise my kids.
Exactly.
I'm not going to help better the schools in these areas that I've just come in, built this tall and skinny, yada yada yada. No, I'm about to exit. And again, this isn't everybody, but this is kind of the trend that we see.
Absolutely, and it's the story in every. Major
every America major city. City.
So it's, you know, it, I mean, Denver is no different.
Right. Right. So, and to kind of switch gears a little bit, I'm curious, as we think about equality, as we think about, you know, kind of facing these injustices that are happening, especially to Black bodies and to brown bodies and to trans bodies and everything in between. I'm curious for your take on this, which is, you know, you look at the local church, generally speaking, still the local church struggles with being totally for all people.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like there is the pockets of churches that are truly say they are for the flourishing of all people. That is not a large list.
No.
And I'm curious, as someone again who has spent time in a variety of church spaces and places for that matter, what's your pulse? What's your take? How do you think about that? What is the thing that you're like, this is why I think this is still a thing, still a struggle? I mean, what I've often said to even my, you know, church friends and other and fellow ministers, it's like, we still struggling to be all for women, y'all. And that's over half of the church. And we're trying to get black and brown and LGBTQIA people and everybody else up in here. It's like, we can't even get the women part right, y'all. So I'm just curious, like, what's your thoughts on that? What's your take on that?
Well, I think when churches say, it is so popular to say we're diverse. Mm-hmm. It is so popular to say we welcome all. And one of the things that I often used to think about a lot is sometimes when we say things like all, our quickness to be so generic betrays us.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's just not possible. All really isn't possible.
Right.
And I think what Christians have to do is, when we make statements like that, we have to be self-aware.
Yeah.
And we have to acknowledge statements like that are aspirational at best.
Yeah.
And what kind of model of welcome are we interested in? Are we interested in, especially if it's a white church, are we interested in a model of welcome that still has the traditional majority still in power and holding all the important positions in the church? Or are we about a model, and this one is more challenging, mm-hmm. wherein it's more like the incarnation. So it's more like, you know, God taking on flesh in Christ and the forfeiting of power, the desire to walk in someone else's shoes, an incarnational model is very different from a model that basically just rearranges the furniture.
Yeah.
And is okay with tokenism. So I think that's a perennial challenge.
Yeah.
And I don't even know, and this is something I've struggled with for a few years, because I actually, as a teenager, the Church of Christ I attended was multicultural, even though all of the elders and the deacons were white. So the congregation was multicultural, but the leadership was not, and therefore the church was not multicultural.
Right.
But after the Obama election in 2008, the minister got up and said, the Sunday after, he got up and said, now we all know the election didn't go the way that we thought it should.
Boy, you better stop. You better quit.
And a number of the black members never came back.
What?
and that experience alone, and there were some racist, you know, like specifically racist experiences that happened in that church too. It made me very skeptical of churches that aspire to be multicultural.
Mm.
Because it's like, you know that Black people have Christianity already. Like, what are you wanting to do? Like, what are you trying to do? You know, why can't you embrace being a white church that is anti-racist?
Mm, wow.
Instead of seeking to be a multicultural church that is still racist.
Yeah.
You know, that's a different kind of authenticity, a different kind of aspiration. So, you know, people are always like, oh, Martin Luther King said 11 o'clock on Sunday morning is the most segregated hour in American life or whatever. Yeah, it's true. And is that bad? Like, is it bad for Black people to have a space to go to wherein they are themselves and are free from the gaze, G-A-Z-E, of white people?
Yeah. Oh, I want to touch your hair.
Oh, exactly.
And it's like, it's that kind of,
yeah,
kind of a, that kind of vibe where it's like,
and it was, you know, that those were some of the first laws in this country. When Africans were beginning to convert to Christianity on this continent, one of the first laws that was passed was that you being baptized does not free you from enslavement.
Which is wild.
So this isn't something that we will just overcome overnight. I mean, this has been 400 years in the making.
Mm-hmm.
And the religious space is some of the most charged space when it comes to white supremacy and racism. The stained glass, you know, the imagery and hymnody, you know, fairest Lord Jesus, that means Jesus is white. You know, just all of these phrases, you know, incantations that we say over and over again that reinforce a white God.
Mm-hmm.
And why, as a white Christian, do I want to invite a Black person into that?
Right.
I don't know. I mean, you know, so there's just so much work to be done.
There really is. And that's so true. And I agree that, like, until you see it in your leadership, and that's a place that where I'm currently, you know, at right now, you know, that has been the conversation. You know, we've got to see it in not leadership in waveform of minister, but leadership in waveform of shepherd, elder, board, whatever it is you call it. It's gotta happen there. And here's the thing too, and what I've tried to often tell people is, like, proximity and location is everything. And I'm not saying that there's a couple parts to that, right? Like, don't, because there's plenty of very white, you know, predominant churches that find themselves in the inner city, right?
Yeah.
In the city sprawl. And it's like, yeah. That's cool that you're like in, like, you're, well, now I'm close to where Black and brown people live, but they're still not coming to this church. And why is that? So that, it's one thing that, yeah, part of the battle and part of the journey, not even the battle, but part of the situation is, yeah, where is your building located? Number two, what's happening inside of the space of where the building is located? Like, those are big deals. And those are big questions that you have to answer. And another thing too about leadership and what we were saying earlier is the folks who have this kind of racism that's kind of, you know, stewing inside of them, they have all the time in the world to run for all of the positions in your cities, in your state. And what we need to be seeing is people who are anti-racist and who are quote unquote liberals or quote unquote whatever, right? Just anti-racist, right?
Yeah.
Period. We need for some of these folks to have the time to start running for elections, to start putting themselves in position of power, because that's what we need to see more of. That's what's going to, we're going to start really seeing change is when the men and women who are white, black, brown, whatever, you know, especially of the white bodies who are anti-racist, saying, yes, I got the time now. I got the money and I got the time. I'm about to run for this. And we're starting to see more and more black people go into politics and really make their way into that. And that's encouraging to see. And so we just need to see more of that. And I think that'll only help serve these younger generations, these teens and college students now who say, oh, okay, I see black and brown people, men and women who are in office. I could do that. I could be senator. I could be mayor. I could be a congressman. I could be sit on the city council, you know?
Yeah, it's, yeah.
Yeah. Well, good. Okay. Well, let's do this. Let's do a little speed round and let's just see where that takes us.
Awesome.
Then we'll we may be done with ourselves here, but this has been great. Okay. So first question is, what are one or two quotes that you love? Some of your favorite quotes. I'm a big quote guy. I like quotes. I like books and I like quotes.
It's a very short poem by Wendell Berry. And it says, whatever happens, those who have learned to love one another have entered the lasting world and will not leave whatever happens, which I love. That's one of my favorite poems. I think that's good.
Oh, no, that's strong. Okay. Albums everyone should listen to.
Amazing Grace, of course, by Aretha Franklin, 1972. The most iconic gospel album of all time.
Yeah.
And PJ Morton's 2018 album, Gumbo Unplugged, and it's live and it's unbelievable. And I got to hear him do it in Denver and it was awesome. Yeah. He's amazing.
Yeah, he is amazing. Yeah, that's good. Okay. One or two books people should read.
A Place for Us by Fatima Farheen Mirza. A wonderful novel about a Muslim Indian American family. And Sabrina and Karina. It's a book by Callie Fargiato Anstein, who is a Denverite. And it's a series of short stories about Latinx and indigenous women in Colorado and New Mexico.
Wow.
It's lovely.
Wow, I love that.
Okay. I love fiction.
Oh, big fiction. Okay. Very nice. Okay, I said to you, like, if you had to leave Denver, but since you've also spent, you know, a little time recently before Denver was Memphis, you can throw in Memphis too if you want to. But if you had to leave Denver today and never to return, what would be some of the must-go-to places before you left town?
Definitely Denver Art Museum. Also the Museum of Contemporary Art, one of my favorite places. A little bar, it's about 50 minutes outside of Denver, called Bread in Silver Plume, Colorado. It is lovely. It's a former bakery, and it's awesome. They have great cocktails. Welton Street Cafe, which is an awesome soul food restaurant, black owned here in Denver.
Yes.
And Uchi, which is the best sushi you'll ever have.
In Denver. Amazing.
In Denver, we are not close to any water.
Right.
But all of the seafood is flown in daily.
Wow.
It's awesome and way too expensive.
Okay, very good. And then what do you think are one or two of the keys to a good life? It's kind of a odd question, I know, but I'm curious. What do you think are a couple of keys to a good life?
talk to people you love every day. Like, don't let a day go by where you don't talk to someone you love. I talk to my parents and my cousin and one of my best friends from college every single day. And
wow.
I mean, I hope that never changes. And only be friends with people who are funny. I feel sorry for people who are not funny.
Yeah.
All of my friends are very funny. And so that's a non-negotiable.
What is a story that or an experience that you had or a part or you were a part of that will always you'll think about and it'll always make you laugh?
It was Thanksgiving of like 1998, and my family, we had all eaten, and it was, I think both sides of the family were together, and we were playing charades.
Oh, yes.
And I just remember my uncle had the word, I think it was the word odor or something. And, you know, he was trying to get us to get this word, and everyone was just screaming and like trying to figure out the word, and like no one could figure it out. It was so funny, and everyone was just laughing so hard.
Oh, man.
And I'll just never forget that. We, you know, both my parents come from really big families, and just holidays together where we would just laugh.
Yeah.
So hard. And yeah, it was awesome.
That's incredible. That's incredible. Okay. Any other keys? That's a really good one.
No. Mm-hmm.
That's it. Mm-hmm. I like it. So, okay. And before we get out of here, your podcast, remind us again of the, it's called what?
Mile High Theology.
There it is. And is it coming out on a particular day of the week, or just follow it on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts?
Yes, it comes out monthly, usually the second or third Tuesday of the month.
Okay. Make sure we check that out if you're not already. Hey, this was great. Thank you.
It was wonderful. Thank you, Patrick. I really enjoyed it.
Yes. All right. We'll see you later. Thanks, everybody. Peace.